You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the New World Pictures podcast. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
Noirvember might be my favorite month of the year.
And Erica.
Sometimes two noirs do make a right. Get it, guys?
Yes.
We got it. Yeah. Yes.
And as Erica is suggesting, we are entering Noirvember 2, where we talk about the noirish movies that New World has released. And to start it off, we are going to have an interview with Eric Blakeney. We've been pushing this off a little bit, holding out for Noirvember to post this, because Eric was a writer on Crime Story, which we have not talked about just yet, but we're very excited to do so. We're saving it. The Michael Mann TV show that was produced by New World Television. But not only that, Eric also wrote the TV movie Generation X, which we have already discussed on this podcast, the very first live-action X-Men story done for New World Television in the 90s. We're going to talk about all of that with Eric, who is the coolest guy. You're going to love his stories. He worked on 21 Jump Street. He worked on Wise Guy. He created the show Booker, and we're going to talk to him about that. A TV show that Mark and I adored at the time.
Yes. Not everyone's a bookhead like you and I, Ryan. Is that what they're calling?
That's right. No, they call them book whores.
Oh, that's why I couldn't remember.
Yep. Because we always give it up for Booker. But we had an incredible interview. We have some amazing stories. Eric is just an incredible guy to talk to. Definitely somebody I want to be when I grow up, because he lives in the south of France. He's lived in Europe for a long time.
He's doing everything right.
Yes. Yes. It was a constant reminder to me during the interview. I was like, oh.
Yeah. I haven't done everything right. Yeah. So that's how that can all play out if you just do the right things. Okay.
Right. Oh, you can be a musician in a band and then go, you know what? I'll just write for TV. Just have a really long and incredible career. Man. I mean, amazing. Wish I, you know. Yeah, there's a lot of listening to Eric and just going, wow. Wish I could have done that. But
well, you didn't, losers. Let's get to the interview.
but then we wouldn't be able to do this.
That's right.
Wonderful podcast.
That's right. Now we're pretty cool too. We also do a podcast. And how many people can say they do that?
Hardly anyone.
So here's our interview with Eric Blakeney.
This is my first time living in France. I've been here tons of times, but this is the first crack. Before this, I was living in Spain and Portugal, kind of bouncing. Wow. And before that, London. And before that, Belgrade. And then before that, California. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. It must be amazing.
What was the impetus for moving after spending time in Portugal and Spain? What drove you to move to France?
My marriage fell apart.
Oh, boy. I stepped right into that one. Boy, I'm sorry.
What can I say, man? It was, yeah. Mm. Yeah. Mm. And so that kind of, she was Spanish, and we had an amazing life for years in Spain and Portugal. And before that, we lived in London. And my time in Spain was over. I'd lived there before. I'd lived in Barcelona. As a matter of fact, I've had two marriages and in Spain. It just occurred to me. So it's not a good place for my marriages. Although the time there is always happy as hell. I don't know.
You should not move back there when you get married, if you get married again. Did you live there in the 70s as well? Did you live in London?
I did. Yeah. When I was a kid, when I was 18, I dropped out of Juilliard and moved to London and, joined a band. I went for 2 weeks and stayed for 5 years.
Wow. Yeah. What band was it?
The band was called Sweet Lemon. they weren't that big, but I joined a series of, they were a big London band, but we never, you know, almost got signed to all that usual stuff. We almost got signed to Rolling Stone Records, and then the New York Dolls beat us out. And it was a spectacular time. I mean, it just, you couldn't ask for a better place to kind of grow up, which is that, you know, that moment between being a teenager and technically an adult. Although I'm still waiting for that adult moment, but I hear it's coming any day.
Don't go for it if it comes up. It's no fun. Just pass on
Skip
it.
it.
I, my dear old drummer friend has a t-shirt. Don't grow up, it's a trap.
Indeed. Yes. Yep. Indeed. And so you leave London, you go back to the US. Were you thinking of writing for television at that point in time, or were you still thinking about music?
I was still a musician when I moved back to the States, and I had this sneaking suspicion that while music was my first love, I might be better with words. So I was as good a musician as you can be without being elite, like that, you know, that billionth of a percent. I knew I'd never be that. And I suspected that I was very good at bullshitting with words, and that I might be a genius level bullshit artist, but not a genius level musician. So,
How did you get to writing for television?
you know, I wanted to be a short story writer, and I was taking lots of classes, writing classes well, everywhere in California, in LA. I was part-time student at UCLA, and a friend of mine was a stuntman, and he said, "You're never going to make a living as a short story writer. Like two guys in history have done that." He said, "Become a screenwriter. You love the movies." And so we went to the movies that night, and he said, "Just look at it and tell me at the end of the movie if you can do that." So I looked at the movie, I listened to the dialogue, I looked at the scenes, I got a feel of the whole thing. And there was a backstory to this that I dabbled in London, but I came out and I said, "Yeah, I can do that." So I just took every screenwriting class in the world. Now, I had played with dramatic writing when I was in London, because I had some friends in the theater, and they had this like little, you know, they're doing scenes from like all these kind of like Woody Allen shows in the early, you know, and there was an actress I really wanted to impress. I wanted to get a date with her, so I thought, if I write something clever, you know, something funny, I'll rip off, you know, whatever Woody Allen was doing, and I did a really good job of ripping him off because I got the date. So that was really the first time I started messing with dramatic writing. I put it down till I needed my next date, you
What was the movie you watched? Do you remember?
No, everybody always asked me that. It was just one of these kind of run-of-the-mill, like 80s action movies. Maybe it was a Stallone movie, you know, just one
Sure.
after the other. And I like to think it was something, you know, inspirational, like Sunset Boulevard, which was inspiring, you know, when I,
Sure.
but no, this wasn't. This is the worst kind of 80s factory action movie. And I just looked at it and said, "Yeah, I can do that. Pretty much any idiot can do that." But yeah, so.
And so was Crime Story your first TV writing gig, or had you worked in on other shows before?
Oh, Christ. Know, I did so many shows in those days. It wasn't my first gig. No, the first gig I had was The Equalizer. So I did The Equalizer, and Crime Story was like simultaneous. And it was kind of,
Did you work on Max Headroom?
I worked on Max Headroom, but that was after Crime Story.
Okay.
I did a Cagney and Lacey. And then Crime Story was simultaneous to me going on staff on a terrible show called Houston Nights, the kind of thing that would have inspired me to become a screenwriter. And
tough times, tough cops, tough drama, Houston Nights.
And then, so yeah, then I had multiple episodes of Crime Story, with, with Michael Mann and company, and from there, I went on staff at Wise Guy,
Right.
which was a really a breakthrough show. No Wise Guy, no Donnie Brasco, no Sopranos. That was
Yeah, a huge
a
show.
really important show. Yeah.
Family. So mom has to go to your funeral to find out you were a good guy?
Honor.
Danny Tessio was clean, and if he was dirty, I'd know, and I'd know who made him dirty.
Maybe you dirtied him.
Country.
You do your job, Benny.
I can't. I'm locked up.
Ken Wall stars in this summer's sizzling hit, Wise Guy, Wednesday.
Probably the most dysfunctional writing staff I've ever been on. And incredibly creative and just so inconsistent. It was the most, I can't say that any of my television career was all that fulfilling or inspiring, but Crime Story was exciting. Not Crime Story, I'm sorry, Wise Guy was
Wise
exciting.
guy. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I was on staff with the same guy who was a Crime Story and Wise Guy. Yeah.
Who was the person that you were staffed with?
David Burke. He was the nominal showrunner of Wise Guy, and he was like the head writer, story editor at Crime Story. So we became very friendly, and he brought me on to Wise Guy, and it was madness. Yeah.
Who brought you on to Crime Story? How did you get that gig initially?
I don't know. I just my agent worked really hard. He was
Okay.
just like out there hustling me, and I had gigs. So when you have a gig, it's easier to get another gig. So
Sure.
they just started piling up, and yeah, I think it was one of those situations. Grab this guy now, or you won't get him later.
Did you interview at all with Michael Mann or talk with him
I talked to
before getting?
Michael. Yeah, he. I think he used to. Michael never read, but sometimes he would read a script of mine, and he'd be like, "I'm going in a different direction. Throw the script out and let's do another one." I was like, "Oh my God." And I'd be like, "You didn't read it, did you, Michael?" He goes, "No." And then, that was Michael in his funny Miami Vice clothes and his magenta Ferrari, and that was
Wow.
Michael. We actually got along much better when during the writers' strike of a couple of years after that, and when I was the showrunner on Jump Street, and we were both kind of outspoken guys for the Writers Guild, and I think he respected me more as a guy who would speak up for the writers than he respected me as a writer. It also used to drive him nuts because he wanted to throw away my last script again without reading it, but the network liked it so much they made him put it back. And that was an ego blow to Michael because just, you don't tell Michael Mann to put this script back that he's just thrown in the bin. But they did, and he shot it, and he was cool to me after that, but
Now, was that New World that read that script, or was that the network?
the
Okay.
network insisted on doing the show as I wrote it. Yeah,
Okay.
and he did
Because
that.
this was after Miami Vice, Michael Mann, or rather during even, Michael Mann had reportedly he was able to do kind of do whatever he wanted with Crime Story, especially
Yeah.
once New World stepped in to fund it.
Yeah.
Did he so you're and it sounds like he was embracing that freedom.
Oh yeah, he was doing exactly what he wanted as the mood hit him. He just wants to go this way, he goes this way. He wants to go that way, he goes that way. And
You did have like a direction though for Crime Story. There a lot of the stories are come up with by Chuck Adamson and Gustav Reininger. I may be saying that name wrong.
There was a Bible, but again, it became a looser Bible as Michael decided he wanted to go in more directions. So the Bible eventually, I don't think my stories were when my screenplays were from the Bible.
I mean, they do deal with some of the elements of like Dennis Farina's life. You have the episode where he goes on vacation with his wife and their marriage is falling apart. And this is like an early, Dennis Farina. He'd done a couple movies with Michael Mann, but he was still pretty much an unknown at that point in time.
Oh yeah.
Were you able to work with him at all or?
No, he was on set in Chicago.
Okay.
I didn't get to know Dennis, so.
Were you ever allowed to go to the set, or were you just basically back in the writer's room?
A Crime Story didn't really have a, you know, they had a story editor's office. There really weren't writer's rooms, that many of them in those days. They were, I guess you'd get together in the showrunner's office, and, you know, Cagney and Lacey had a writer's room. They always did. They were really organized and together. I really respected that, yeah.
So you were just sort of given assignments and you went off and wrote them and then came back for notes? Is that how that worked?
You know, the first story I did, it was something I pitched them. And then Michael, it wasn't from the Bible. But David Burke loved the story. And Michael just said, no, I'm going in another direction. So he kind of gave me multiple episodes and just said, write a different script. And he gave me the story. And then he let me do another one later, and he gave me that story. So I don't even know. I might have read through the Bible, but it's so long ago, I can't really remember.
Sure. But yeah. Did you just write those like at home, basically, and then brought them in, or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, nobody got any offices. There was one writer's office, and that was it. Huh. When David got fired, Bob Isley came in and got that office and had to deal with all the crap, and, you know, so I worked through, I guess you could call it, two story editor regimes.
Hmm. And now your episodes that were in the first season, they're both directed by Aaron Lipstadt. It sounds like you didn't get any chance to meet anybody, but he got his start with New World.
I didn't realize I had the same director on both episodes.
Yeah.
I like that.
So I'm guessing you didn't get a chance to meet him.
No. There was a serious hierarchy and a serious separation of church and state in Michael's world, more so than I'd ever seen on any of the shows I've been on. I mean, even my first Equalizer, I went to the set in New York, and, you know, I was just a freelancer on my first gig with a writing partner, and, you know, they were pretty cool to us, you know.
So yeah. when Crime Story comes out, it initially starts pretty well in the ratings. It starts to dip, though, as the season goes on and they move it around the schedule. Were you tracking any of that? Or at that point, I mean, you were just sort of looking for other writing gigs?
I was looking for other writing gigs. I really didn't care. You pay attention just in that you speak to everybody, you know, about these things. So, you know, I felt that the show had to drop in the ratings because I felt like the Dennis Farina character, Torella, was just an idiot. Why couldn't he catch Ray Luca? It's just like, how can you go on with the same guy again and again and again and never catch him and never make the bus? What are you going to, you know, it just becomes a little cartoonish, like the Roadrunner never being able to get, you know, the Wile E. Coyote can never catch the Roadrunner.
Right.
It's for adult drama. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And that really carried over into Wise Guy because David Burke was now running that show, and he made a decision that he wasn't going to go Ray Luca on Wise Guy. And as popular as the Ray Sharkey character was, and as new as it was in that he completely bonded to the hero, he made a decision to, we were going to let him go for the whole season. And he made a decision that we're going to get rid of him halfway through. And we were all horrified. It's just like, this is so beautiful the way this is working. And, but he said, I don't, you know, that was the way he convinced me, because we'd both done Crime Story, which is, I'm not going Ray Luca. I'd rather kill him off early than kill him off too late. And he was right. And, you know, I went away and I thought about it. I was really pissed to be losing Sharkey. And I ran back into his office and said, David, I know exactly how we can kill him. Let's do a two-parter. And I threw this stuff at him. And he and I wrote it. I took part one. He took part two. And it was definitely the best, you know, thing we that was done on Wise Guy.
And Ken Wahl was the lead in that series. Mm-hmm. He also made a couple movies for New World. Did you get to work with him at all?
Yeah, I knew Kenny. Yeah. Yeah.
How was he to work with?
he wasn't, I don't know, the sharpest knife in the drawer. You know, he was okay. You know, I got along fine with them. We talked about basketball more than, you know, and his bum knee and my bum ankle. And then when I moved to Jump Street, we were going to challenge. We had a really good basketball team on Jump Street. And our star player was this tiny little girl from Extras casting who was the point guard for the BC national team. So we'd go to the gym, to the Y, and challenge everybody and kick the fucking shit out of them just because of her. Just these giant black men tearing their hair out and getting really upset because, you know, we just look like pushovers. And she's like, wherever you are on the court, the ball would be in your hands. You get clear for 1 second. She's like, it's a little tiny Magic Johnson. So Kenny and I were constantly talking shit to each other. You know, him saying, oh, you know, if I could put a good team together on Wise Guy, you know, we'd kick your asses. I said, come on down. Come on. He never did. So, we didn't talk creative stuff. I mean, a little bit maybe on the two-parter where we ended Sharkey, because Kenny was also really upset because he loved working with Ray Sharkey.
So was this just like a TV like basketball team league where different shows just played different, or how did that work there?
It was, well, because we all shot in Vancouver. These were all Stephen Cannell shows. So 21 right. Jump Street was a Stephen Cannell show. And the other one, Wise Guy, was also Stephen Cannell. So, and we were the two biggest shows. 21 Jump Street was Fox's biggest show. But Wise Guy had a little bit more cachet because it was, you know, breakthrough show. And
sure.
21 Jump Street was, you know, Pretty Cops starring Johnny Depp, who was, mm-hmm. you know, at that point was just, the pretty boy du jour. So the rivalry was all in the Cannell building. And they encouraged rivalry. You know, everything was about who's the best writer in the building, what's the best show, who did the best episode this weekend, you know, and it was, everything was rivalry. So the only thing I took part in was the basketball team rivalry, because I knew we were unstoppable. As long as we had little Sherry, I would have taken on, you know, the Lakers summer basketball team.
That's amazing. I watched 21 Jump Street at the time, both Mark and I, but we were particularly taken with Booker and watched all that. And I know that was you created that, right?
Yeah. And got fired off it before it aired.
Oh, really?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. How did that happen?
I had, my TV career was always coming up with the right idea 5 years too soon. And it kept happening again and again. And I'd probably always get fired for it. So what my idea for Booker, I didn't want, you know, a Cannell Uzis and Jacuzzi show, which is what it became when they fired me. I pitched them something a little bit like Twin Peaks the year before Twin Peaks came out. Mm. I wanted to, the whole premise was that normal people and the suburbs were terrifying. And that's where the real crimes in America are committed. And I wanted that as the kind of premise. So, like, you know, Booker's this badass, you know, this kind of Mickey Rourke type with the, you know, the leather jacket and the cigarettes and the cool hair. And so what I wanted to show that is in the world of normal Americans, these poor badasses are just kind of antiquated, romantic, mythological figures who just get eaten alive by dull suburban people. Nobody got it. I my star could not have been hotter. Barry Diller, who ran Fox at the time, gave me a choice. He said, "Listen, you can create Beverly Hills 90210," and I just said, "I'm not doing another kids in high school show." Beverly Hills Brats? No. That's one of the massive successes. I have no regrets. I would never have done a good job on that show. It was just too awful. So and then he said, "Well, you want to do a rock and roll detective?" And I said, "Well, I don't know what a rock and roll detective is, but yeah, let me do that as a spinoff of the Booker character. We, you know, Johnny Depp doesn't want him on the show anymore, and to keep the peace, let's spin him off." So they said, yeah. And they gave me like a full season order. I mean, I could do no wrong. Talk about hubris. So I walked in with this crazy idea of how to do a detective show to allow Americans to explore the darkness under their normality. And the Fox executives who were all there like in a row on the couch. And I don't know how they got that many people on the couch, but I guess they were all incredibly thin. But I just like these mouths agape. I finished my pitch. I just thought I pitched the coolest thing in TV history. And that night I got fired. And Stephen Cannell took it over and he made it Uzis and Jacuzzis. I never watched an episode. Like my old staff were like, oh, yeah, you know, it's just what you said it would be, you know. And I think they sent me the script. So I read the pilot script and I went, okay, next. I got a lot of money for it, but you know.
So how do you still get the creative credit? Because
I created the character of Booker. So
That was.
I created him on Jump Street. I created the show. I pitched the show. And, you know, because it was my character, they gave me a created by.
And when Richard Grieco comes into Jump Street, he gets a lot of attention. Johnny Depp had obviously gotten the main focus of that TV show, despite being somewhat of an ensemble show. But was he just not happy with the amount of attention that Richard Grieco was getting?
Yeah. I didn't really, you know anything. They brought me into Jump Street when they were in crisis and they were going to be this, the network had shut them down. So I came in and I rewrote the script in 2 days while it was in prep. It had already been. So it was a real crisis. And I kind of took over the last 5 episodes of season 2, I guess it would be. And because I'd kind of saved the last season, and they gave me the show the next year when the showrunner left to do a deal at Disney. And so it was very politically weird. They made me the supervising producer, and there was an executive producer who was in fact a line producer. And they called me in and say, listen, for political reasons having to do with Wise Guy, and David Burke is the showrunner. He was only called the supervising producer. They were very weird about titles in that building. So they said, listen, would you like to be the showrunner of Jump Street? But we can only give you the supervising producer title because we can't mess with David. And they said, but you'll be the boss. So I said, wait a minute. So I'll be the supervising producer, but I'll be the executive producer's boss. They said, yes, exactly. So like I was the first Dick Cheney. It was fantastic.
Did that create like, I guess, political challenges that your title doesn't equate to what your role is? And so
yeah, there were,
I could imagine you get pushback.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It was, as I say, it was a very competitive environment. And the people that had been on the show before me felt very resentful that I stepped in. You know, a year before that, I was a freelancer. They interviewed. A year later, I'm their boss, everybody's boss. That doesn't sit well anywhere in Hollywood. And there were a lot of problems. Also, because for me, the writing was everything, all the other crap that goes into a TV series. My only thought was, in order to make my mark, I have to elevate these scripts more than stunt casting and, you know, time slots and all the other crap that goes into this stuff. So I was more exacting about the scripts, and some of the old staff just couldn't live up to what I was going for. And they would, their episodes were so bad. I was compared to some of the new material we were turning out that I was in danger as a showrunner. It's like, why, you know, so I had to cut loose some, you know, some people, and I brought in some really, you know, good young writers who all became big showrunners. I brought in Wong and Morgan, and they went on to do massive things. They did X-Files and the Final Destination and movies, and Michelle Ashford, who went on to do, you know, all these massive TV shows. So we had to elevate the kind, you know, the quality of writer there. But politically, the guy who was my executive producer, but worked, he was constantly undermining everything. And they were really, they were trying to get me off the show. Now, Johnny Depp and I, when they first brought me into the show and I kind of saved the day, we got along fabulously. We'd get drunk together. We'd play guitars all the time. You know, I'd show him, I don't care what he says now, I showed him how to play Brown Sugar and the right way. And everything was great. And so when they gave me Jump Street, I thought, okay, I have to leave my mark. This show is too cutesy. Like, everybody's so cutesy and nice. And I wanted a Mickey Rourke style bad boy when Mickey Rourke was just absolutely extraordinary. So we found these two guys. There was like a network cutie that the network really wanted, who was just dull as dishwater. It was just like a typical, you know, 80s nice. And then there was Grieco, who wasn't a strong actor, but he had that one little bad boy quality that I was looking for. And I knew I could make it work with him. I knew I couldn't, he had nowhere near the range of Johnny Depp. Johnny Depp's an extraordinary actor. Richard Grieco has one thing he does really well. So, I knew that Johnny wanted to leave the show because he wanted to become a movie star. Silly kid. In any case, I was so stupid politically that I thought, okay, you know, the guy doesn't want to be here. Let him go. But they wouldn't do that. They were holding him to his contract. So I thought, if I bring in another pretty boy, they'll let him go. So I thought Johnny would love me for bringing in Grieco. I really was that stupid. And when I brought in Grieco and he got all the attention, Johnny turned on me. And he got angry as, oh, man, and difficult. And I remember one day late, probably a little more than midway through that season, I get a call from my assistant. Johnny Depp's on the phone for you. I said, okay. Hey, Johnny, what's up? He says, Blakeney, your script stinks. I'm not doing it. It's like, oh, I said, man, you know, I really thought you would go for this because it's about, you know, kids in prison and the kind of responsibility and like what a shitty thing we do as undercover cops. And I said, the scene in the, you know, in the tunnels below the kids' jail with the girl from the girl's side of the jail, I said, that didn't mess your head up a little bit? It goes, well, I haven't read the script. I said, okay, do me a favor, John. Read the script. If you don't like it, don't do it. Never heard another word from him. He gave a sensational performance. The scene I asked him about with this, you know, 14-year-old girl, he squeezed out this lone tear that absolutely punctuated the moment with genius. And it was a very controversial episode, and it kind of elevated me to that level where I could get to be fired for creating Booker in the weird way that I did.
It seemed like a theme is that people just don't want to do your scripts but haven't read them. I mean, that happens a lot.
Yeah, especially when you're dealing well. Johnny was reacting to the guys who were trying to get me fired, you know, the executive producer, that little cabal that had been there before me. And they just said, oh my God, you know, we got this new. Now the network hated this script too. So it was easy to see, like, so they could feed this. The net, you know, it was a dark script and it really challenged the Jump Street premise, which I hated the premise, which is putting cops in jail to bust our children, I think is despicable. So this show was that they had to go undercover in a kid's prison and look at all the faces of the babies that they've busted. And it was a hard and dark show. And when we did it and the reaction was so insane, but it was a crucible. The network hated it. The only person who stood up for me was the president, Peter Roth. And when the network said, we're not accepting this script, Peter Roth just said, well, fuck you. We're shooting it anyway. You don't have to take it. And really, I've never seen that done, especially for a new showrunner like me. And he did. And they shot the show, and it was a smash and a critical acclaim, and it was an absolute heartbreaker of a show, and that kind of that changed things, for my career. But no, there's always all of these political things going on, and it's always very little to do with the writing. It's always has to do with the positioning, and everything in Hollywood is about positioning. And anybody who tells you otherwise is just a team liar. Everything is about positioning.
So after Booker, you start, I think you eventually start writing TV movies, right? I know you also did a stint on Baywatch.
I went into development hell. So I got paid a fortune. What happened was, getting fired from Booker, it's like normal. Stephen Bochco had been fired from Hill Street Blues. They don't hold that against you initially. So I went to all the networks, and they were like, what do you want to do for us? And they gave me network deals and everything. I said, I want to do a show about a bad guy. A bad guy is going to be the big thing. And they'll tell you, well, we can't do shows about a bad guy. And I said, let me write one. And I wrote a pilot for CBS in 1990. It was basically The Sopranos 8 or 9 years earlier, and they all loved it. But Jeff Sagansky said, I can't put a bad guy on TV. And I said, well, we just had one, the Ray Sharkey arc on Wise Guy, which everybody fell in love with the bad guy. He says, yeah, I'll lose all my sponsors. There was no HBO there. There was HBO, but they weren't doing HBO. I went through a period, my most fruitful period, right around that, 89, 90, 91, 92, where I was writing incredible, unique pilots that I never had the clout to get off the ground. Had I done a repeat of Jump Street or Wise Guy, that's all they wanted from me. And if I'd been clever, I'd have positioned myself to do another one of those shows, get it on the air, maybe make it, maybe it becomes a hit, maybe not. But I didn't think in terms of positioning. I thought as a writer, I thought, let me do the most incredible thing for them. And, the vision will win out, which was, just wrong. You have to be in a position of power where you're allowed to do the things that you are coming up with. I remember I had a couple deals at ABC. And Bochco was always beating me with shit shows. Well, one was really good. One, like Cop Rock beat out this incredible pilot I did. And they all said, we love your pilot is 1,000 times better, but he's Stephen Bochco and you're not. And so we have to put his show, for the 10 o'clock time slot. Everybody's fighting for that 10 o'clock slot. And so it's all about positioning. It really is. So you were asking about TV movies.
Yeah, you start like you did for Fighting for My Daughter, like that's in 95. Is that where you were starting to, were you just picking these up as jobs just to kind of keep working at that point?
Yes. Yeah. At that point, I had started to cool off. I hadn't been on a show and I didn't want to go on another show. And I just thought, how can I keep going without, I didn't have what it takes politically to be on a show. I didn't like working for idiots. I wasn't good at it. I couldn't bite my tongue and always take the stupid way out in order to position myself back into the power. And I tried it a couple times after that and it never worked out. You get under pressure. So I started doing some TV movies. And the Fighting for My Daughter movie was a really hard thing to write because it was such bullshit. And they send me to Vancouver, this woman who dresses up as a hooker to go with her best friend to go find her daughter who's been pulled into prostitution. And, I get up and I meet these people and go, this is not what was happening. She couldn't wait to get dressed up as a hooker and go parading around town and flirting with guys. It was a family that was in that life. But in any case, I wrote a, a pilot that was not a pilot, a TV movie that had had some humor in it, because I thought it was really funny what a lot of what this was. And those kind of TV movies have to be taken very seriously. So they gave my script to Lindsay Wagner, and she said, yes, she loved it. And we ran into the elevator, to each other in an elevator. Was it at New World? I'm not sure where we were at. I said, hey, Lindsay, you know, I read this. She says, God, that script was so much fun. Why did it turn into such shit? I said, you know. Anyway,
well, speaking of bullshit, comic book movies, you were sort of speaking of and being ahead of your time. Generation X is certainly the first X-Men movie, live action, and yeah, well ahead of the X-Men movies that would follow in the 2000s. Yeah. Were you familiar at all with the X-Men and those characters at the time?
Stanley and I were old friends, Stanley and myself. Stan gave me my first job in Hollywood. He liked me so much, he convinced Marvel to give me like $1,200 to write an outline. And it was just like more money than I could drink away in 2 months. so we were pals. Every day I would go to his house, pick him up, and I had this giant Buick convertible, and I used to go around town with a World War I flying helmet and a white scarf and, you know, and my big old beater. They would call me the Road Warrior. And so I would pick Stan up, and he'd say, let me wear the flying helmet. And he'd put the flying helmet on and hand me that scarf, you know. And so we would bomb down, and we would have to find a place where we could drink together, which was difficult because I drank, you know, white Russians, and he drank chocolate milkshakes. He was complete teetotaler. So we had certain places where we could go where I could get an actual drink and he could have a really good chocolate milkshake. So it was really nice because, I mean, this was the early 80s when I got to Hollywood. And Generation X was, I think, in the early 95, they started developing, maybe not late 94, right in there. Maybe late 94. So what show was that? I might have the chronology a little bit off, but that would be about when it was. So
that would
I
make sense because they had like one of their comic books sold in 1994, sold like a million copies. Like it was huge. Yeah, yeah. It was huge. Generation X was a giant property at that point in time. It would make sense to then start trying to find a way to develop it.
Yeah. So that would be about when we started the development. So I guess I'm in offices at New World. It must be Bruce Salen's office, the producer. And so they asked me to pitch a story for this. And at this point, I've been on this whole run of UFO research. I pitched an X-Files show the year before X-Files. All kind of complications with that because we had an order. That's another story. I wonder where that was. USA ordered it. But so I was in this kind of metaphysical trail. So I pitched a story where the bad guy could invade your dreams. And I said, you know, there's something called the dream matrix. And I did this pitch of the dream matrix where the bad guys could do all terrible things. They could get inside your head and make you jump out a window if they wanted to get rid of you. And I did the pitch, and it was a little bit like the pitch I did, the Twin Peaks pitch I did at Fox. Stan, who was my great champion, Avi Arad, Matt Edelman, executive there, and Bruce Salen, and they're just jaws are agape. I get a call from my agent, you know, an hour later. What the fuck are you pitching? What's this dream matrix? What kind of thing is this? I said, well, it's just a dream dimension. He said, well, why didn't you? I said, you know, dreams are another dimension. That's pretty simple. He goes, yeah, dreams are another dimension. What's this matrix shit? I just thought it was a hipper name than dream dimension. He says, well, drop that shit and fix this. So I dropped all that shit. I fixed it. I went back and said, okay, dreams are another dimension. And a bad guy can go anywhere through your dreams. And they were like, oh, that's kind of cool. You know, so I said, the dream dimension. So like, got it. Got it. So the network gave the okay. We shot the movie. They let me even come on and produce because I'd only been hired as a writer, but they were so happy. Even Bruce Salen, who originally was the one who called my agent and said, what the fuck is who was ready to have me fired, became my greatest ally. And we really enjoyed each other. And so he got me on board. So we went up to, you know, and produced it in Vancouver and on Vancouver Island. And $3 million budget for an X-Men movie.
Yeah, and I was about to ask about that. I'd read like $4.5 million, but
no, I wish I had $4.5 million. I would've, God, with that extra million and a half, the things I could have done. Every penny you're fighting for,
right? And there's a lot of special effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess.
you're literally
doing special effects. That is just okay. We got $20,000 here. Can we do something on the computer for so-and-so? And I thought they looked horrendous, but that was all we could afford. We did something in television history that has never been done before, which is, you know, again, something I'm so proud of. We got the first sound of a fart on network television. Everybody had alluded to it before that, you know, people would wave their hand and all that kind of thing. But we actually, and I remember fighting with the network, and I was just like, come on, brother, this is 1990. I guess it was by the time we filmed it, I'm not sure if it was 95 or not, but you know, there's not, nobody cares. You're not going to lose a sponsor over a couple of farts, man. And the whole idea was that Matt Frewer said, at an executive board meeting, he said, I went into all your dreams last night, and at exactly 10 o'clock, you're all going to have an involuntary gastric eruption. And you know, so the clock is ticking. I just thought it would be the coolest thing in television to get this chorus, but they gave me one fart. I said, come on, give me two. I'm not giving you two. This is very cool black guy going into Samuel Jackson from the straight-laced Ivy Leaguer. So, motherfucker, you're not getting two farts on my show. negotiating. I got it. And I made a terrible mistake. I gave it to the one lady gave me the best physical reaction, but it was like the third person. So the rest of the people were burping, and I should have just gone with the first guy, breaking the silence with it. And it's just like, oh God, please let me go back and recut that and put the fart in the right spot. Anyway, so television history right there, babe.
Is this supposed to be funny, Mr. Tresh?
Yes. And effective.
Now, did New World at all, like, you go in and you pitch the whole dream dimension, but did they tell you to use certain, I mean, they were saying, we want to make this Generation X, and did they pitch, like, certain characters?
Sure, and the guy who created Generation X, I said I needed a couple extra characters, and he said, well, what about a guy, because I would know, you know, I love Stan, and I liked all those Spider-Man comics and everything when I was 10. Mm-hmm. But unlike so many of my contemporaries, I actually outgrew them. And I'm still to this day do not understand how a grown man follows a comic book character. But, you know, that's too judgmental. And
Mark feels seen right now.
I feel seen right now. Thank you.
I am sentimental about my youth. And you know, I guess, you know, the bands of my youth are still really important to me. But the comic books, I devoured those things. You know, a new Spider-Man comic got delivered to the mailbox. And my mother said, hey, Eric, you got a new comic? Whoa. It's like, stop everything and read the comic book. I actually learned how to read very, very early on. My mother tells this story, you know, because of young Einstein. But I remember some very big guys who are probably like, I must have been two or three. And they were like, they were showing me a Superman comic. And I saw these brilliant characters and these bubbles. And I did not know what these hieroglyphics said. And they were explaining to me that there's this thing called reading. I was just, fuck me. I've got to learn this immediately. And my mother said, she taught me and she said, you were reading in a few weeks. And just like, boom, so comic books kind of drove me intellectually to try to decipher the great mysteries of the universe. That was literally that moment. So I do have a real affection for comic books. And I guess I understand. I make fun of all my friends who are still into comic books. But, one of my favorite people was Stan Lee, and he was always, when we used to go drown our sorrows in milkshakes and White Russians, and every session would end with him going, Blakeney, I don't understand that. Spider-Man would make a great feature film. And I'd be like, okay, Stan, you missed your time, and just like... And to his credit, he winked at me after the first one was massive, and he says, Blakeney, did I tell you? I said, Stan, you were right. You were right, brother.
Yeah. So you're saying that the creator of Generation X, Scott Lobdell, was the writer, and Chris Bacalo was the artist. But was he pitching? He said you need a couple extra characters because there were some of the characters that probably would have been too difficult to use, right?
There was no tech. You couldn't in those days. Like they'd been I think they'd done some kind of Flash character, and it was just like you have to film him in slow motion. And so the network was like, we don't want to see a Flash character running in slow motion. So we didn't have the technology to just really get the sense of speed. And we didn't have the budget to even try to create a facsimile of that. So we're really operating on, they were like, look, you can do two or three things. And we'll give you a little money to do, the dream dimension. So we had to do artwork to put these guys on a green screen and stick them in the dream dimension. And that ate up most of the budget. And it looked like shit, but we had to do it. and then we had the stretchy arm, which looked ridiculous as well. But I thought it was such a funny character. Like and one of the other characters who's like bullying him when he gets to the school is just like, your skin stretches, like, what for? It's like, he's like, he could touch a stone and turn into rock. So I don't even remember it because I didn't know that. I got so much flack for the Jubilee character not being Asian. I didn't even know she was Asian. I just was writing this stuff. And the best, they had all... a whole lineup of every ethnicity came and read, and the person who got the role, she was the best. She was the best actress, Heather McComb. She was really a strong actor. So she got the part, and then it was like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "Shit, I didn't even know. I didn't know. I don't read. I rarely ever read the source material. I'm as bad as the guys in."
As Michael Mann.
I'm not reading your script sucks. No, I didn't read it, but it sucks.
So you were involved in casting though.
I was, because they brought me on as a producer. So Finola Hughes was really good. And and then they put her in that stupid wig, which we all hated.
Yeah, she was trying to get away from soap operas at the time, I imagine.
She was great, and she was a lot of fun. And she walked in, and she was ready to play the character as American. She had her American accent down. And then we were sitting there because, the woman comes in, this elegant voice. And we says, can you just do it in your other voice? She says, no. She said, I learned this thing with an American accent, all my inflections, every little bit. I said, okay, listen, you know what? Lose that shit. You got the part. Come back as a British woman. We laughed, and that was that. Yeah.
I had read that Jeremy Ratchford, who played Banshee, that he was cast on tape, which I think even for the mid-90s just seems kind of...
God, I don't know. I don't remember. I remember that we hung. So when we were shooting that, the three regulars at the bar were Finola, Jeremy, and me. So we had a nice little circle. I absolutely adore Jeremy, and I brought my Stratocaster up, and we would jam. And I thought, what did he play? I think he played harmonica, or he'd start singing, and we would just, you know, just make fools of ourselves into the wee hours and show up on the set. You know,
what was his drink of choice?
Oh God, I don't even remember what my drink of choice was then.
we were beyond white Russians at the time.
Yeah, that was my milkshake concession to Stan Lee.
Oh no, was Matt? You get those nice filbert nuts with a white Russian, so you get a meal and a drink.
Oh, you do? That's I've kind never of had nice. Any nuts with a. Wow.
Oh yeah. So, well.
Yeah. Game changer.
Next time.
Wow. I'm gonna start again. Well, you can't get a cocktail here anyway in France, but
Matt Frewer, was he one of the first people cast, or he was one of the first announced?
I don't remember the order. I do remember that Matt was so brilliant and doing the Jim Carrey thing before Jim Carrey was doing it. And we were shooting, and the director comes up to me and he goes, oh, listen, Eric, you wrote a brilliant script, and I'm trying to protect every line of dialogue. He said, but Matt keeps changing it and coming up with new shit. And I said, listen, I'm going to be the guy who gets the writing credit, and Matt is coming up with more brilliant lines than I could ever dream of. You just let him go. Anything he wants to say, shut up and shoot it. And I said, now for everybody else, no, they can't change a preposition, but Matt, anything he wants. And he did. It's like every time there was, you know, like a punchline, which he had a bunch of punchlines in his scenes, everyone was different. And I said, print them all. I mean, and we would be there and just have like, you know, three great choices to end the scene with. And I don't even know if we ever picked the right ones. We would just pick the ones that made us laugh the most that time. And then we looked at it later and go, oh, we should have picked that other one. That's even funnier. And it's just. He was brilliant. We became good friends. Yeah, one of the incredibly bright man, incredibly talented.
And you'd known him from Max Headroom?
No, I had not met Matt. I mean, obviously I knew who he was because I'd done Matt at Max Headroom, but the show was canceled before they even shot my episode. So.
Oh. Yeah. Oh. Okay. And now Jack Shoulder is hired as the director. Yeah. And at this point, he's doing a lot of TV movies, but obviously he had done the second Nightmare on Elm Street. Was there something about the nightmare dimension that maybe had a hand in casting him? Or, sorry, hiring him?
I didn't. I didn't hire him. You know, it just looked like, you know, sequels to horror films just never work for me. They just, yeah. You know, I thought Nightmare on Elm Street was well done. You know, I left it up to the line guys. And so you do think this guy can make his days, and he didn't. And they were going to fire him in the middle of the shoot. And he was very difficult, but I fought to keep him. And because I really... First of all, I don't want to hurt anybody's career that much. To be fired in the middle of a TV movie is going to really hurt you. And I also feel that there's a continuity that a director creates. Jack had a vision, and he was executing it. He just couldn't make his days, and he was spending half a day on, you know, calling for jib arms to shoot, you know, a guy at a computer, which is great if you're, you know, doing an X-Men movie with a $200 million budget, you know, get the jib arm and spend half a day just on a guy typing, you know, great. But they just had enough, and I had to really fight and had to be personally responsible to keep him in line. Which was really, you know, a difficult thing. He was very childish, kind of like a man child, you know, really tall and dorky, and but had a vision. So I just, you know, we just stayed with him. But I was not. I had no part in hiring him, though.
Okay. Now, at the time, New World it was still making Marvel stuff, obviously, because they made this, but they were also, it was supposed to be, Generation X was supposed to be like one of three Marvel movies that were made for TV that they were going to make for Fox. Were you aware of those other projects, or were you just concentrating on Generation X?
I might have been at the time. What happened was they were so happy with the TV movie that Fox ordered a Bible for a TV series, which they hired me to do. And then weirdly, New World was sold, I think, to Fox.
Yes. Yes.
They killed all of it. Now, whenever a studio or network is sold, the new executive who takes over kills all the projects from. So they paid me to go home, which used to be my favorite thing, because at that point you have a contract to do something, you know, and you know, every time you're getting at least 100 grand, you know, sometimes 200. And it used to be, we bought a vineyard in the Napa Valley and we built a little house there. And every time I'd get fired from a job, I'd call up really excited. Honey, pack the kids up. I just got fired. Let's go to the vineyard. So New World got sold. They killed all the pro. And I didn't understand. New World had ordered the Bible. And now they owned it. It made perfect vertically integrated sense to move forward, but not on the agenda of the executive. And I think the executive at New World might have been Brandon Tartikoff then.
It was. Yes.
Well, he was a legend. And the guy taking over for Brandon Tartikoff is not going to do Brandon's shows. It's just, there's nothing, again, positioning. If the show's a hit, everybody says, well, it was Tartikoff's show. Of course it was a hit. You know, if it fails, you're the idiot who greenlighted. So they know there's no position for them in this. So they come in, they kill everybody's stuff, and they go from there. So that's what happened with it.
Yeah. How far along did you get on the show? Did you just create a Bible for the show? Did you write any scripts or?
No, we didn't. I think I just outlined some story ideas. I don't, like, the Bible wasn't even finished when the sale was made. They just made my deal, which meant I was going to be paid. And then it was like, I was jotting down ideas. That's all. And then it's just like, oh, the project's been killed. Okay, honey, pack the car.
Yeah, it comes out in February 20th, 1996. That's when it airs on Fox. Yeah. Were you excited when it came out? Were you aware of it? Did you watch it?
I did watch it. It may be one of the only things I've ever watched. But the reason was I had a neighbor who had had that Falcon Crest vineyard, you know, and he'd come to visit the set and got to go drinking with Finola and Jeremy and me. And it was just like the greatest moment of his life. So when it was aired at his place, he threw a big party for it. And my dad was in town at the time. And so, you know, I had to go. I mean, I couldn't not go. So sure. There was, you know, everybody had a good time. And, you know, I thought, you know, the special effects looked so bad. It really looked like a $3 million movie. So, you know, while I cringed a few times, I so loved watching Matt Frewer that was really all I saw. And the kids did a couple of good lines. There was a couple of good moments for the kids. I don't remember any of the kids being terrible. There were a couple that were not yet fully formed as actors yet. A couple were, you know, as I say, Heather was awesome. The guy, oh God, what was his name? And I can't even remember what characters we created. Because Scott, I needed to yes, the character who can things zap out of his eyes.
Refrax.
I called Scott up and I said, listen, man, you know, give me a character that can shoot shit out of his eyes because I have no money for special effects. We need this kid to do something. And he goes, okay, he shoots shit out of his eyes. Call him Refrax. I said, you got it. Okay, bam, you know. That's so you're really you're, a lot of it was the limitations of like some, you know, we have stretchy guys so we could stretch his arm and we had the guy who could grab like a boulder and turn to rock, all you had to do was like a color change.
Yeah, Mondo, right?
Lighting effect, Mondo, yeah. He was good. That kid was good. He was good when he was bullying Augie, the one who played Stretchy Man.
Skin.
And Heather was great, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it just seemed like the movie was made to then have more episodes later, like where you would get into the kids and learn more about them.
Absolutely.
Which was a big thing at the time in television, to do a big pilot, a movie length, and then have the show. So it definitely feels like
it would've made sense,
the start of, you know, we'll get to more of these characters later as the show goes, and then the show didn't go because New World got sold. But you guys do shoot, as you said, in Vancouver Island, and you used Hatley Castle, which is what they ended up using for the X-Men movies later.
I saw a lot of things from earlier drafts in those later X-Men, you know, Xavier University stuff, you know, so,
Yeah. Do you watch those and kind of go, well, I was there in the 90s.
They may have done that, yeah. I don't enjoy superhero movies anymore. I'm just burned out on them. They're just all the same.
Mark is very, he's feeling this. He's really feeling
I'm
this.
I'm sorry, today. Brother. I'm sorry.
No, I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I've been saying the same thing on this podcast. And I feel so validated that somebody is saying, believes and sees what I see.
See, because Mark doesn't like superhero stuff. So every year around May, we watch a bunch of the New World Marvel stuff and make him watch it. And he's not into them, but we force him to watch it because he doesn't care for it. So he's really feeling seen today.
Yeah. It'd be impossible to get me to watch that many of them. But, you know, I realized also that, you know, in this time that watching everything constantly being remade and looking at the way music has developed, and you realize commercially that pop culture is for kids. And I find it weird, you know, somebody my age will say, oh, you know, you're not listening to Dua Lipa. Like, what's the matter, old man? You know, and it's just like, well, I've heard all that stuff before. This is like the 50th incarnation of that kind of musical genre. Right. And it's the same in film. How many incarnations of Spider-Man can you do? So you realize that the executives, being very astute, they go, well, look, every 5 years, there's a new crop of kids, and they don't know anything that happened 5 years ago. So you can basically take the hit movies from 5 years ago, or even 10 years ago, which would be ancient, remake them with cute new people, and have a big hit on your hands. So why wouldn't you do that? I think the new generations suffer because there's no inventiveness anymore. All they can do is be inventive technologically. So these move, but story-wise, it's not possible. They're just regurgitating the same stuff with new faces, even better special effects as they get better. So I feel like younger generations are missing out on the awkwardness of creativity. You know, I remember an interview with Frank Zappa when he was still alive, and he was saying, you know, the reason we were able to do things like the Mothers of Invention and do all this weird 60s counterculture music is because the executives didn't know what kids wanted. So you would go and say, hey, what about this crazy new band that does this and this and that? And the executives goes, I don't know, try it, see if the kids buy it. And they would do that because they didn't, you know, they didn't have algorithms and formulas and market research. They just said, I didn't know. So there's an incredible burst of creativity happening. When you can have people like Frank Zappa making mainstream records, this is counterculture jumping to the front. I feel bad for kids now that they don't have an actual counterculture because the machine doesn't allow it. The machine knows exactly what to do.
Yeah, it knows your habits, and it feeds you what you have told it that you want.
Yeah. No, now it's gone, you know, into Brave New World territory. But even, you know, even the last 30, 40 years, the demographics, the market research. You know, they obey this tremendously. I do have a funny story from Stan Lee days. We did a pitch. He had a black superhero, Power Man, and mm-hmm. we had Carl Weathers attached to do this movie. And Carl Weathers was just now the massive black star with you know, the Rocky movies. And we had Jerry Henshaw, a great in-house producer, early champion of Star Wars, and he was a veteran. So we did this magnificent pitch to the two executives at MGM, and they just loved it. And they just said, "God, this is just spectacular." And I'm just saying, this is the first pitch I'd ever done. And Jerry, I was so nervous. Jerry Henshaw had to start the pitch. And then when he got them going, I was able, he kind of looked at me and said, you know, kid, start running. You're the writer. So then I did. I just jumped and it was magnificent. And Stan was just loving it. And they said, oh, God, great pitch. This is such a great story, blah, 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 blah. Except for one thing. The market research tells us that black people buy 30-something percent of action movie tickets. It's like, yeah, we knew that. We knew that. This is going to be big because we got it. They said, well, the problem is that the market research tells us also that they don't like black men in the hero roles. They like black men as the villain or the sidekick. And I just thought, this has got to be a joke. I'm looking like, to Jerry, even Stan is dumbfounded, and Jerry knows we're dead. And you know, we went through, and he said, "Okay, well, thank you." And I was like, "What just happened? What just happened?"
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a market research. Is just what just happened? And I said, "I don't believe the market research, man. I don't believe the black people don't want to see black heroes." Mm-hmm. And they were like, "Kid, it doesn't matter what you say. You're just the new fucking kid, you know, writing. Forget it. We're out of there." And I mean, it would take Stan, what, 30 more years to make the black superhero. But
yeah.
I guess sometimes the market research isn't correct.
Yes. Yes.
Who knew?
Yeah. Speaking of Stan, I just was curious. Did you talk to him about his feelings about Generation X?
Yeah, Stan was really happy with how it came out. Blakeney, you were killing us with that Dream Matrix shit, he said, but you came through. They asked me to do a feature, Ghost Rider, the Ghost Rider movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know what happened. I think I left town to work on the Mad Max movies, so I couldn't really do the Ghost Rider film. Yeah.
You're blowing my mind. Mad Max movies.
The Fury. They were. This was the late '90s. George Miller had been put together with me a couple of years, right around this time, because he was thinking of doing Mad Max as a TV series at Warner Brothers. And Greg Mayday, who was a great champion of mine from Warner Brothers, always wanted to get a show with me. So he put us together, and George and I really hit it off. And then George decided not to do it as a TV series. And he was on the outs. And then he came back with Babe, which was smash. And yep. I got a word from my agent that he wanted to have dinner with me. He's coming to town. Now, I think he's going to offer me Babe too. And so I go to dinner, and he and Doug, his partner, said, "Listen, we want to do with the Mad Max as, you know, feature again. Will you come to Australia and work on it?" I said, "Yeah, yeah." So I went and spent 6 months kind of early conceptualizing what Fury Road would be. And with a lot of, again, I so enjoyed George Miller. He had such a good mind. And but he had a very wrong idea about a certain thread that he wanted to do. And I was like, "George, we can't do this. This is eugenics. And he's, no, it's not eugenics. It's science, blah, blah, blah. I said, George, it doesn't matter that it's science. An audience will accept this as eugenics. And we can't say that. And, you know, we argued a bit. And I also got the word that, hey, you know, you're taking liberties with George that, you know, the only person who's ever been allowed to do that was his late partner, Byron Kennedy. Their company is called Kennedy Miller. And he says, you're not Byron, so stop it. You know, I was like, okay. So I spent my 6 months. He did listen to me later. And I threw a couple of my two cents. I got to name, you know, Nux Vomicus was one of the warrior boys. And a few little touches got in there, but mostly, you know. They gave me credit in the book about it, but I didn't get a screen credit. I didn't deserve a screen credit. I should have been there. I should have gotten a consultant credit, but I didn't deserve a screenwriting credit. I didn't. It, you know, it gone too many iterations. It took him another 15 years to make, 12 more years to make the movie, and through a lot of iterations. But yeah, so I worked on Fury Road.
Wow, yeah. That is amazing. Did not expect that. You also you directed your own movie, and so I just wanted to ask you really quickly about it, Gunshy.
Yeah.
Charlie Mail?
New York's most stressed out cop.
Maybe you got that weird sleeping disease. Narco sleepy.
Might have a chance with the city's most charming nurse.
Where are you from?
Ireland.
Top of the morning to you.
If the mafia's worst assassin.
Put your hand on the table, I won't say it again.
It's a paper. Let the neighbor go.
Doesn't find him first.
That's the guy who's going to kill me.
You are a deranged nut.
Ah, but am I an attractive nut?
Gunshy, rated R.
Yeah, because Liam Neeson just had a big movie that just came out, and Liam Neeson's in the movie. Have you thought about directing again, or how was that experience?
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Probably directing those actors was the most I've ever enjoyed my career. The politics at Disney was the worst thing that ever happened to me, by far. it probably cost me my career in Hollywood. Yes, I tried to put some films together and got very close. And how do I put this? CAA blacklisted me, and I couldn't get any CAA clients to be in my films after that. So
why did they do that?
I made a star very unhappy.
Okay.
I'd rather leave it at that, because that's a whole complicated.
Of course. No problem.
It's like, you know, two episodes of a podcast.
sure.
The politics are so complex, and I was again out of my element, just really happy to be creative and really good at doing that. And I mean, you know, Liam at the end after the film was going all over town and telling, you know, De Niro and all these people what an amazing first time director I was. And he, you know, he was incredibly effusive, and we became pretty close for a little while after that. But there were a couple things wrong, a few things wrong politically at Disney. The executive that we got, that CAA forced that deal into Disney, Sandra's sister ran her company. Sandy produced it. And we hated the team at the Disney acquisitions that wanted to finance this film, but we got shoved into it, and there were a lot of politics. The executive had Gesina, Sandy's sister, removed from the film, and she was kind of my partner in all this. So there were a lot of ugly politics throughout. Disney never got the movie. It tested really well, which hurt me, because they were going to do the film as an acquisition and lay it off at a more kind of independent studio that would know how to release it. Okay. This was a bit offbeat, and we were using Liam Neeson in a comic role, and Liam was great, but no audience at that time wanted to see Liam in it. He was Qui-Gon Jinn. They did not want to see him in a funny movie, and it was a funny movie. It was actually funnier than I anticipated it being. My script was darker. Sandy cast Ollie Platt in it. And Ollie changed the tone of the film. And I loved it, but it wasn't, he was not nearly, Gandolfini wanted that part right before The Sopranos. And I wanted Gandolfini because I knew he'd be scary. And but Sandy and the studio didn't want him. I wanted Jeff Bridges in the lead. The studio said, are you kidding? This guy just did this terrible movie called The Big Lebowski, which is bombed and blah, blah, blah. And I was, okay. You know, it's just like the studio politics just, as confident as I am in certain of my skills, the ability to navigate Hollywood, it's amazing. I got anywhere near as far as I got. No ability whatsoever. So it was very difficult in all those ways. The studio made a lot of money on European pre-sales before I started shooting it. We only shot the movie for $10 million. Sandy, Liam, and Ollie all did the movie for scale, which is called X Schedule, at $75,000. They loved the script that much, and they were all fantastic. But Ollie changed the tone of the film, and in such a beautiful, it just made it sweeter and more fun. And I just went with it. It was just like, it wasn't what I thought it would be, but the movie took on a life of its own, and decided it was sweeter than the writer had conceived it. And I was okay with that, because it was kind of a joy to be involved in this. Ollie and Liam were in love with each other. They just couldn't stop laughing. The hardest thing was to get a take, because the two of them, you know, would be giggling, you know, and they'd be giggling at their lines, you know. So I'd be like, guys, could you stop it, please? And be like, Ollie, it's your fault, man. You wrote this funny shit. Stop it. Stop yourself. Give me a shittier line. You know, it's just, it was a great time. It was fantastic. But Disney dumped it out. The way the business works, while they all took $75,000 each to do the movie, they had bumps based on box office. And there was a zone where if the movie had made between this and this, like moderate, you know, kind of almost successful to moderately, you know, or kind of successful, where the studio would have lost money based on the bumps that they would have had to pay to all of these stars. So they looked at it and they said, you know what? We're in profit now and we don't have to do anything. We're obligated to dump this in a few theaters to meet our obligations to the European financiers. And they were thrilled. And it made a fortune in DVD. And it was, and Disney said, hey, Eric, if you ever want to do another one of these films, I said, oh yeah, bring you three A-list stars for free. Yeah, okay, thanks.
So did you start making any other movies at that point, or did you start working on other projects, or did you just run over to the winery?
That was the first time I escaped to Europe. We sold our vineyard, moved to Europe, lived in Barcelona for a few years, and I started trying to put another film together. I had my movie put together. I had Val Kilmer was going to play the lead in this very cool kind of French comedy that I'd put together. And we were going to finance it out of Spain. And I lived in Spain. I owned a beach property in Spain. And Catalunya was going to accept me as a resident filmmaker. It was all perfect, except for Woody Allen. Woody Allen shot Vicky Cristina Barcelona, and they made him a Spanish citizen when he didn't live there. They gave him a Spanish residency. And he took advantage of all of the incentives that they were giving to Spanish filmmakers. So when it was my turn up, I went through Barcelona, through Catalonia. They accepted me as a local. They approved my residency as a resident filmmaker. I got to Madrid, and Madrid said, we can't do it. Every filmmaker is furious over the Woody Allen thing. And if we do it, we'll be crucified by them all. And so the film fell apart. I could not get the financing done out of Spain. Mm. You know, I tried with Val to do it a few more times. Val would have been great. So it was always this hit and miss. And I was, but I did some ghostwriting at the time. I would do some script doctoring on European films, a bunch of French films, and a couple of Scandinavian films.
And that's it. That is our interview with Eric Blakeney. Thank you so much, Eric, for coming on the show and letting us pick your brain about Generation X and Crime Story. Truly amazing. So great we got this opportunity. We're so grateful. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you, Eric.
Yes, thank you, Eric. That was awesome. And again, could have talked about Booker for 35 to 45 more minutes.
Such a book whore.
Thank you, honestly, for indulging us and getting into Booker a little bit. That was a highlight.
Yeah, for sure. If you want to check out more of our episodes of Noirvember 2, you got to go to our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com. You can check out our Noirvember 1 episodes. They're all there. Plus t-shirts, articles, all the rest of our interviews, all of our episodes, it's all there in a singular hub on the internet.
On the internet.
On the internet.
It's on the World Wide Web, everybody.
That's right. You have to put that in first. Oh, boy. I hope you guys understand how the internet works. But if you do, go to our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com.
First, download Netscape on your on your PC.
Hope you have enough hours on that AOL disk.
Hope nobody picks up the phone when you're trying to connect to the internet.
And we'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast, a part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network, please select the link in the description.
The audio commentary. It's a dying art form, but here at One Track Mind, I, your wonky yet affable host, Ryan Luis Rodriguez, analyze film through the prism of these embryonic forms of podcasting, one audio commentary at a time. Masterpieces, crapsterpieces, live action, animation, cult classics, films literally no one has ever heard of. No track is too small, and no track is too big. Join me and my guests from the entertainment world as we keep these features alive every other Tuesday. Hey, who else is going to discuss Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey one week and Citizen Kane the next? Us, that's who. Sure, you have to put up with my voice, but there's a certain give and take in this industry. That's One Track Mind, part of the Someone's Favorite Productions family, and available wherever you get your podcasts.